Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 272 featuring Matthias Bueller, who is the CTO and founder of VRBN Studios. Pretty cool stuff, right, Kristen?
Yes, it was amazing to listen to. It was just effortless in the way he talked, I said.
It's cool, actually. And speaking of that, actually, this is one of our recordings that we've obviously been doing remotely now that we're sort of isolated at home. So he is actually in Switzerland and I was in Los Angeles. Yeah. And we've been using this new system with Squadcast to do it, which has been really great at enabling us to sort of see each other and still be able to, create a pretty cool dialogue that's going back and forth. That's really cool. There is a lot of stuff that's in here because what basically VRBN does is a lot of stuff in terms of city building and urban simulations and things of that nature. And a lot of the tools that they've been developing has been used in feature films and visual effects, as well as architecture, urban design, even, self-driving car simulations. So it's pretty cool what's possible to do in this stuff. What were some of the cool stuff that you remember, Kristen, from the podcast?
Well, it was awesome that he got to learn from Hani Rashid and Greg Lynn, who you raved about as well. Yeah. And then he explains procedural city modeling as like baking. So I'm a huge baker. So I was like, that's awesome. He said there's a rhythm to it. And everything starts with a polygon. So a nicety of geometry really well.
Yeah. It's true. It was really great to have that and to sort of see, understand what's possible in that area. So really great to have him on. And we talk about a lot of stuff and I don't want to give a big spoilers on the whole podcast. So we're just going to go ahead and talk about some announcements. We have some cool stuff to announce.
Yeah.
Obviously a lot of people right now are working from home and we want to be able to support them in terms of their efforts in terms of their personal projects as well as their education. And we have some really cool things to help them there. So what are some of the things we have, Kristen?
All right. So you can go to chaosgroup.com to find this out. But we have the Education Collection, which launched like last week. And it's 150 a year. And it includes all the V-Ray products except for Katana and Nuke. Mm-hmm. And you can find out about this at chaosgroup.com/V-Ray/education-collection.
Right. And basically, if you have an EDU address and you basically are a student or an educator, $150, you get everything that Chaos Group makes with the two exceptions of V-Ray for Katana and V-Ray for Nuke. But you do get all the Phoenixes. You get V-Ray for Rhino, V-Ray for SketchUp, V-Ray for Max, V-Ray for Houdini, V-Ray for Maya, V-Ray for Unreal, all that stuff. It's a really great deal. $150 is an amazing deal for the year to do that. So go ahead and sign up and get that. What else do we have?
We have the cloud discount, and you can render at home with Note Bundles, and this runs until the end of April, so it's good to go get those now. And the credits do expire, but you have 3 months after you purchase them, and you can go to chaosgroup.com/cloud to find out more about this.
That's right. So our cloud credits, normally you get volume discounts if you are going to buy cloud credits, but now we're basically offering the maximum discount for any volume that you want. So if you want to buy one credit, you will be able to get that. I don't even know if we start with one credit, but like it's very cheap. So go ahead and get the biggest discount you can on cloud for right now. And as Kristen said, they do expire after 3 months. So you can buy them now until the end of April, and then you have 3 months to use those credits. But if you're working on a personal project or you're doing stuff that you need to get out and you don't have access to your studio because you're stuck at home or whatever, go ahead. We'll help you out with some V-Ray Cloud credits as well. We have one other thing, which is also pretty cool, and that just came out a few days ago, but go ahead and tell people what that is.
The V-Ray Personal Learning Collection from Maya.
Right. So the PLE license. Now, you don't need an EDU license to do this. Basically, if you want to learn V-Ray for Maya, you can get the PLE license, which is the Personal Learning Edition. And the Personal Learning Edition allows that you can use V-Ray for Maya for non-commercial uses. There's a few restrictions in terms of what's possible. But if you have a passion project you want to do while you're at home, or you're a student and you say, you know what, I really want to learn V-Ray for Maya, you can now get it for free. for absolutely for free, and you don't need an EDU license to get it. So, and like we said, there are some restrictions, but it's a pretty robust version of V-Ray for Maya that you guys can check out. So check it out, V-Ray PLE license. Again, you can find all this information where, Kristen?
You can go to chaosgroup.com.
Right.
Yeah.
Perfect. And if people want to find out more about the podcast itself, where can we go?
So they can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Perfect. Thank you. And if you guys have any ideas, now that we're doing these podcasts remotely and we can talk to anyone in the world, let us know. Give us an email, labs@chaosgroup.com. We would love to hear from you if you have any ideas or anything you want to do. And lastly, of course, as I always say, we would love to get your feedback and your ratings and your reviews and your shares on Apple Podcasts. So if you're on Apple Podcasts, go ahead and leave us a review, give us a rating, let us know what you think. And if you really like it, make sure you share it with your friends. All right. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
All right, Matthias. So this, you're my second person that I'm doing remotely, obviously. We are in the middle of this global, I won't call it a crisis because it sounds too depressing. but it's definitely a different world where we're all of a sudden heavily relying on technology to be able to communicate with people. And this actually seems to be interesting. Lots of people are coming up with innovative ways of communicating and working together. What's your thoughts on that, actually, before we sort of get into too much of the other stuff?
It's, well, to me, it's a strange situation also. But though I'm let's put it like this, I'm a little bit shielded because I'm working quite a lot, and actually my where I live is very close to the office, so I'm kind of shielded a little bit from real world, and I'm trying to kind of also stay a little bit away from bad news all the time, but in general, obviously we're all also affected here,
right?
Strongly. It's certainly a challenging time, but I see a lot of very positive potential that in things that people don't take for granted anymore, like being safe or being relying on or having to rely on other people and so on. So I see it as a positive thing within, or I'm always trying to find the positive side of things.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree. I think that we need to find a way that we can grow out of this, right? So we can find new ways, not taking things for granted as we did. As you realize how many things you sort of take for granted nowadays, you know, like, that's not as reliable or as, you know, important as I thought it was, you know?
No, absolutely.
So that's interesting. But I do want to get into VRBN and sort of how that all started. But before we do that, let's talk about you. What are some of your origin stories? How did you start to get into computer graphics and end up being where you were? What were some of the things that initiated that journey for you?
The very starting point was, I would say, back in the early 80s, were games, video games, or computer a very, very old computer we had at home. That was the very first touch, but obviously just games. But then slowly starting to realize that this could actually be something like a career. I remember there was at the magazine store years ago, where I suddenly held in hand a magazine. It's actually a famous German magazine called Digital Production. And really? It showed these 3D renderings, and it's one of those, should I say, one of those memories. And I thought, well, this is somehow connected to what we can see in the cinema. And then a little bit later, around the time of 1992 or so, I started to play around with some of the first graphics programs myself. It was also around the time of Terminator 2 and Jurassic Park and so on, which actually inspired quite a lot of 3D artists. And right. So it's trying to tinker around these things with on my own in my spare time without being able to talk English very nicely, which was very hindering by the time back then.
Yeah.
But slowly I got further in that field.
Yeah. So where was this?
That was here in Switzerland.
Okay.
So in the heart and center of Europe.
Yep.
with the Swiss Army knife and cheese and chocolate and so on.
Yep. Don't forget.
And the fondue. exactly.
Yeah.
But the thing is, back then in let's say outside of maybe London and Los Angeles and so on, 3D was pretty much non-existent, or especially not in Switzerland, maybe a little bit in Germany, but that was a challenge. And so I thought, well, if I could, I would go in that direction, because I was always drawing as a child.
Right.
But I didn't have the opportunity to learn or go to a school and do these things. Right. And so I chose a different path and actually went in the direction of architecture, which is kind of related to these virtual worlds.
I was going to say that architecture was probably the only other field besides the movies that was sort of looking at doing 3D and doing renderings and at the time.
Correct,
right?
Correct. Yeah. So it was also for me the next closest thing. And
right.
Yeah.
So you ended up in architecture school in Switzerland.
Correctly. So yeah, no, that was at the ETH in Zurich. And I saw one of the episodes that you did was with Greg Lynn.
And oh, yeah, of course.
By the time I started at ETH, he had an assistant professorship there, and I actually wanted to go study with him.
Uh-huh.
But actually, by the time that I reached that semester, he had actually just gone again.
Right.
But instead, there was another guy called Hani Rashid. So I did a semester with him.
How was that? Because I've always wanted to talk to him. I've always admired his work, and he's such an interesting person. I saw him do a lecture once at Rice. Sorry, I'm just a big fan of his. I'm a really big fan of his. He did he did a lecture at Rice. It was him and his brother, and his brother, of course, is Karim Rashid, who's the famous industrial designer. Mm-hmm. But Hani Rashid is, you know, Asymptote, right? Is that correct? Yeah, that's his.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Out of New York,
and he must have been very interesting. Tell me a little bit about what it was like with him.
It was very experimental, but yes. I think that's. Also, the background of the I don't remember what the school in New York was. Was it which university?
Oh, is it Cooper Union?
Was it Columbia? No,
could have been Columbia. Cooper Union was a very small school that did a lot of experimental work as well.
Could be, yeah. But that's so somehow the type of thing we were doing was very, very theoretic and instrumental, very obviously also strongly influenced by Lynn's work.
Right.
So that was eye-opening to me in the sense of how you can approach architecture, especially also with the new tools like Maya and the whole milling machine, which we the CNC mill and so on with which we worked. But then on the other side, what I also thought, or that was a very, very strongly influenced me, is actually the psychology behind how you visualize or articulate the meaning, or how you actually transport your thoughts visually. So in the sense of, if you're doing a rendering with blobby shapes, right?
Yep.
So how do you actually communicate without the let's say, it's hard to describe, but like blobby architecture goes very well with reflections, right, and transparencies. And but how do you go in the dialogue, in the architectural dialogue, behind those just visual nuances in rendering technology? And okay, basically, what was fascinating to me was the rendering quality was very often misunderstood with the quality of the architecture.
Interesting. Describe that a little bit more to me, because I think that's just fascinating. Keep going. Yeah.
I just thought that, well, I had this, first of all, an internal dialogue, but also with my co-students. And hey, kind of in the sense of, hey, how can we render this so it looks better? Or how did you get this nice reflection rendered? But on the architectural side of the dialogue of the concept and shaping volumes, and that's like a marginal side effect, which is more actually distracting.
Right.
And I found that very, very interesting, that the psychological or communicative component to how you visualize architecture and talk about it in images. And a very, very similar example is that I encountered later on, after I had finished my master's degree, and was actually working in architectural visualization for about 9 months, is that a very similar example is if you're doing a visualization of, let's say, an early stage urban planning, project with a site, with site design.
Right.
So if you actually go in and let's say it's just cubes, it's just volumetric cubes,
okay,
and you're just implying certain urban planning strategies whatever level. But somebody goes in and actually assigns a brick texture to those volumes.
Okay.
Or even makes the facade, for example, like in structural glazing, so like lots of glass and implying certain construction
and materials
and construction types. Mm-hmm. Then people in the dialogues actually start to discuss that it's going to be a brick building.
Right.
Right. And so I named this like the level of abstraction that mm-hmm. the level on which you discuss architecture or the concept needs to be reflected in the approach, in how you visualize something. So if you want to talk about volumes and urban spaces, mm-hmm. Using very, very concrete materials to visualize something, you're over implying, and this can mislead the whole communication.
So this is an interesting point. And for years, everyone says, yeah, don't put something that is not a decision made yet, right?
Correct.
Into the design, because that's what people are going to gravitate towards. So don't put down a parquet floor when you don't intend to put down a parquet floor, right? So it is, right? So so there's always this implication of not making something look real, just to make sure that the discussion is only about the form or only about this, you know, the flow or whatever you're going to do in your space. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for years that's what everyone kind of said. But it was very, very interesting, because I did a podcast with Patrick Schumacher. Who's now the head of Zaha Hadid Architecture. So he was Zaha's a partner for a long time. And now since she's passed, he's sort of taken over. But he had this implication that he believes that it should be photoreal from the beginning, that the person doing the design should be honest about what things look like from the beginning, and therefore not kid themselves that this is just an expression of some kind. And they should take into account, like, well, what is it going to look like when it's real? You don't want to have to make all these decisions, and then when you make it look real, realize that it doesn't look good. Make it look real from the beginning. So that was a very different approach that I thought was very interesting. What are your thoughts on that? Because obviously he's very blobby architecture person as well, right?
Yeah, no, I get the other side. I also get this point of view.
Right.
But I think it's how fast do you want to come and actually come to a point?
Right.
How fast do you want to go concrete?
And what you're trying to communicate, I think, also, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, it certainly also depends on who the person is that you are talking to.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's, for example, like a set of politicians that don't have the architectural vocabulary, you need to argue different argue differently then because you cannot use some of the terminology and you kind of have to simplify the language so that your thoughts are getting across. And I think that I'm a fan of clear communication with clear, simple visuals.
Right.
But still being honest about what it could potentially represent.
Okay. Yeah. I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. It was very, very interesting to see that. And there's, you know, it was interesting. I mean, you said you listened to the Greg Lynn podcast, and it was, you know, it was interesting to hear because Greg was at Rice University back when I was there, and he was basically talking about, and when was your class with Hani Rashid?
What years? 2005.
Okay, so yeah, early 2000s. So that was, you know, during that time, you know, it was 94, 95 that Craig was there, and he was saying, you know, back then it was like experimental architecture. Let's just throw a bunch of NURB surfaces out there and see if we get something nice, right? Right.
Yeah.
And that was both exciting and also the complaint about it. Like, you know, it's like, are you really designing anything, or are you just basically like, ooh, let's see what happens, you know?
Yeah.
And so he's actually said at this point, it's like, we know what we get, so we don't do that anymore, right? We've learned, we've gone through that educational process.
Yeah.
And so that has gone away from being, you know, an experiment to becoming practice and becoming its own dialogue or its own thing. So what are your thoughts about that, about how architecture and how the tools that we use in computer graphics have changed the form of architecture, not just as an experiment, but as a language now?
Mm-hmm. I mean, on the theory side, everything that, for example, Lynn is doing and the people that come after him, like Zaha Hadid and Hani Rashid and so on, everything that they are doing is meanwhile backed up by theory, by architectural theory. So it's consistent, right? And also the buildings are functional, everything works, it doesn't collapse and so on. I think that's fine. Where I see a different tangent, which I also found very, very interesting, is that I'm deviating a little bit, but I think it's an important point. And I realized this, that when I was a consultant doing 3D design or geo design using procedural city building technologies or a tool called City Engine. I was using that quite a lot. And we were, I was there working in a company out of the UK, and we did a design charrette in Philadelphia, the PhilAU. And there the students were actually using some software that was doing automatic like parking level for rainwater drainage.
Okay.
So they were using, it's a plugin for AutoCAD.
Okay.
And then we continued a little bit just in optimizing where do the drains need to go. And I did some of that stuff in a landscape architecture office manually. Then you see the software iterating thousands and thousands of variations, and in the end it's optimized.
Right.
Then I said, okay, this is interesting, but okay, there's another plugin that actually designs parking lots, hundreds and thousands of parking lots, and the only thing that you can change is parameters.
Right.
Like distances and curve radii and all of that stuff. But what I found is that software is starting to, because it's so complex, it's starting to limit the design space in which an architect can operate. And I believe it shouldn't. That's just a statement. I believe it shouldn't. Because it's not, you cannot design outside of what the software allows you to do, the boundaries.
Right.
That in the sense of, for example, or one of the other examples was like designing on a huge set of land, just create parcels. Like you see that, for example, in suburban areas where you just have meandering streets, and then the software decides how the parcels will actually be subdivided. And then this is where the buildings go.
Right.
And so pretty much the idea would be, if you fly over an area, you could see, this entire area was actually designed by AutoCAD or using AutoCAD. And another design, look, this looks like the form language which comes out of another tool, like ArchiCAD or Nemetschek, and so on.
Yeah, I think that Lon keeps joking. He says Boulder, Colorado is the city designed by SketchUp.
And this is the tangent where I think doing experimental thing with NURBS and blobs and whatever tools, scripting, programming, anything goes, even with a pen and paper, which I regularly go back to. Mm-hmm. This is completely feasible, but I see the computer and the software just as another tool, as another pencil that should support you and not limit you.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. I think that obviously, you know, there is an idea of simplicity that people enjoy, and it makes them get to a point very quickly. But it also guides their choices in a way. It's not necessarily that it limits them. It just gets them there so quickly that they seem like, well, there it is, it's done, and not realizing that there's more to it, right? I mean, I see it. You would see it constantly with Grasshopper, right? And I know Grasshopper is a very powerful tool. But when you look at all these facades and all these buildings that are all over the world now, and they all look like they were designed with like someone who opened up Grasshopper, manipulated a few settings, and go, I guess that's beautiful, and then we're done. It's like they all look the same. And ironically, they shouldn't. The whole point is that they should all look unique and very organic, and they all look the same.
Point. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's very interesting, because it does bring back the idea of procedural design and how that works, you know, because obviously when we were looking at when Greg and Honey were doing all these very interesting organic shapes in architecture, they weren't necessarily using procedural tools. They were using just a different kind of tool that allowed them to create a surface that was not necessarily, equilateral rectangle sharp shapes and boxes and stuff like that. It allowed for a lot more variety in terms of their shapes. But procedural design is very different. So tell me some of your thoughts about procedural design, because I'm sure it influences a lot of what you do today as well.
So there's creating, for example, NURBS in Maya is pretty much you draw the mathematical, it's like a mathematical derivation of the physical world's need. So you think about the task at hand, you want to actively design something, and therefore you are drawing a curve or a NURBS curve.
Right.
Which evolves into, for example, blobby architecture. But it's derived by a real world need and by conscious decision making. Now, then there's parametric modeling, which is, for example, Grasshopper is a very good example where you actually set up some geometric constraints where lines depend on each other, and then you can optimize for certain parameters and so on. And then also emerging is a certain geometric, let's say, language or solution, which is also, so you're also setting up some sort of system which allows you to reach a certain design solution.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's procedural, which I did quite a lot of, Yeah, I can maybe elaborate a little bit on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
How I got into this.
Yeah.
But the procedural approach, you hear this quite a lot. Meanwhile, with tools like Houdini and the tool that I was involved in for quite some time was City Engine, mm-hmm. and the procedural comes from the term procedural comes from the term procedure. So it's like some sort of cooking recipe, in whichever definition you can see that.
Yep.
It's a sequence of instructions that you typically write in code on or in some sort of logical network.
Right.
And but each of those systems has its own benefits or pros and cons, and depending on the project or depending on the task at hand, you would choose either one of those.
Okay. Okay. Let's get back to what you were saying. Like, how did you get involved in that? What was the thing that mm-hmm. sort of instigated you in getting involved in City Engine?
So after my studies at ETH, I was working for about 8 months or so in a landscape architecture office mm-hmm. In Zurich. And I realized then that classic architecture is something that is not for me. The education was fantastic, lots of different components that you can learn. But it was just a whole management thing. In the sense of too many meetings and clients not understanding what you want to do,
yep.
And so on, and too many meetings and so on. I just didn't like that vibe. So I knew that I wanted to go in a more, let's say, creative field. Not to say that architecture isn't creative. It's just a different vibe that I was after.
Right.
And also during my studies, or since I was rendering since the 90s, I had a huge advantage over my co-students, and I knew that I would want to do something more with graphics and rendering and these things, back to the roots, back to the
right.
the virtual world. And so I decided then that I would actually want to learn a little bit more about 3D graphics. In 2008, I went to the Noman School of Visual Effects for about 6 months. So I stayed
in Los Angeles.
Correct. That was in LA. Uh-huh. And that was right about the time when I heard that the tool called City Engine was released commercially mm-hmm. Out of Zurich from a company called Procedural. Mm-hmm. But
City Engine had been around for a long time in some way, shape, or form.
Correct. Yeah. Since that was, it's been around. The original author, which is Pascal Müller, mm-hmm. he's a SIGGRAPH legend. Yeah. So he's a computer graphics legend. And he pretty much developed it during his studies, during his master's thesis, and then also during his PhD
right.
At ETH Zurich. And then he founded a startup after that, while during his PhD.
Right.
And so I saw that this was, the office was in Zurich, and I would head back to Zurich anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to reach out to Pascal and say hello mm-hmm. and say that I'm from Zurich. I may go back there, and I'm curious to hear more about the tool and maybe if there's a chance to potentially work there, right?
Right, right, right.
Being an architect and loving 3D graphics. And so he said, hey, that's very cool. And in 2008, they had actually a big exhibition at SIGGRAPH.
Yep.
And they presented the Rome Reborn, historic reconstruction of Rome.
Yeah.
So I met him and a couple of guys from the team.
Yeah.
And then about a year later, I got in the team and learned a lot about procedural modeling.
Yeah, wow.
And been doing that ever since. So that's been pretty much now for 10 years.
Right.
Procedural city modeling and things like that.
Okay, so explain what that is and what, you know, give us some examples of what people use that tool for.
Yeah. So the general idea on how the tool works is that you have a shape. It's a polygon. It can be like a square or a circle or something like that. Mm-hmm. It has to be a polygon.
Okay.
And then you assign a rule file to it, which expresses in a language, in a scripting language, how this input geometry should be processed.
Okay.
That means, for example, you can say shape, and then you have an arrow, like a notation for an arrow, mm-hmm. and then you say extrude.
Okay.
Like literally written down as a script, and then this can be generated, and then the circle becomes a cylinder.
Right.
And then you have, it goes further. So, for example, if you take a square and extrude it to a box, then you can use some semantics right. to actually dissect this volume into sides. So the vertical sides would be on a box, would be the facade if it were a building.
Right.
Right.
Got it.
And then for each of those facades, you can go in and say, okay, if the south oriented facade will be, let's say, the main facade. Mm-hmm. And the more code you write, the better you can define the structural methodology of the archetype, how the building is supposed to be built.
Right.
But the system is actually doing the 3D modeling for you. You are just telling it the instructions on what to do.
Okay.
And the more code you write, the more detailed your architecture can actually become.
So you're instructing the computer to build it as opposed
correctly.
To
actually building it. You're giving it the recipe.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And the advantage there is that because, and this is very, very applicable to architecture, because architectural very, very strongly depends on, let's say, geometric rhythms or patterns that are that can very easily be expressed in such language
okay.
or such a language. And once you have the recipe, you can actually assign the methodology, or you can assign this rule to, let's say, 1,000 footprints or 10,000 footprints, and generate cities like that.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, that's a very good description of how this works. But you can continue to build more and more and more out of this, which is why it becomes a city, parameterization. But are you designing architecture in this manner, or are you? Or is architecture being built using this manner, or how exactly mm-hmm. does this work?
The applications typically, and I did a lot of tech support in the team there, so I saw thousands and thousands of different cases of how users are actually wanting to use the software
right.
or apply it, but in general. There's at the moment not yet the possibility to actually derive construction plans.
Right.
But where the tool is really good as is kind of prototyping, let's say, simpler volumes for designs for
urban planning.
Massing studies.
Yep.
And you can also evaluate the geometry to extract, for example, volumes and number of floors. You can generate all sorts of very interesting
right.
Statistics with the tool. And therefore, it's very, very feasible for architects that especially work on larger sites to get a feeling about the massing and so on.
So let's say you're an urban planner, right? Mm-hmm. And you've laid out your grid of your streets
yeah.
as how it's going to be. But then you've put in a bunch of zoning restrictions on each area, right? You could
yep.
feed all of that information into the tool you have, and it could basically populate you and give you an example of what this possible new urban setting would render. Is that correct?
It goes in that correct. It goes in that direction, but it's not 100% accurate.
Okay.
There's a tiny little differentiation, but it technically goes in that direction.
Okay.
What you have to do is you know the limitations, or let's say the zoning codes or the zoning regulations,
okay.
and those actually influence in how you write the code.
Yes, of course.
Right. So you're trying to embed the semantics or the logic of the urban zoning restrictions into the code.
Okay.
Now there are some certain limitations, but usually around 95% of the cases you can work around if you know how to circumvent certain things or work around or simplify, so that you can still get very, very feasible and accurate results.
Interesting. Yeah, I remember. And it's interesting that you do that because, and I think someone with an architecture background is very important in terms of understanding what that is.
Correct.
Because yeah. I remember my first movie I was working on was Day After Tomorrow. And I think we were at, this was 2001, 2002. We were exploring City Engine at that time to see if it would be something that we could do.
Then you must have been working with Eric Hansen, right?
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, because that's a very cool anecdote. One of my fond memories.
Oh, okay, go ahead, tell the
from
story.
When I was in Hollywood, actually, because I saw Eric's DVDs, Noman DVDs, yep. the environment DVDs, mm-hmm. and then I saw that City Engine actually appeared. And actually, Pascal Müller, who was the original yeah. author of City Engine, presented City Engine for the first time together with Eric Hansen.
Oh, right.
And so I wanted to go to Noman to actually take a few classes with Eric.
Yep.
But by the time I actually arrived, he stopped teaching there. So that was a bummer.
Oh, yeah.
But one of my co-students actually knew him in person. Uh-huh. He worked with him.
Yeah.
And he said, hey, I can give you a quick introduction. And this actually happened. So I went to visit Eric in, it was Venice Beach. I believe he lived there.
Mar Vista, yeah.
Venice Beach.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, the circle closes, world is small.
Yeah. Eric got me my job at DD. So he was one of the people that recommended I joined there. But yeah, he's a very interesting person and really kind of one of the first guys who really sort of, embraced the architecture to visual effects bridge in some way, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, he told me a little bit about the stories and how he got into ILM back then with, and then also some of the anecdotes of the fifth element.
Yeah.
And, I mean, obviously this guy also has a background in architecture, yep. and which then brought him into visual effects. So I see there's a certain common story that we all seem to share.
Yeah, he and I both worked at Gensler before we went into visual effects. So it was kind of
that's a compliment.
but okay, sorry, but back to the story, because this is interesting. It's so funny how it's such a small world. but so we were working on Day After Tomorrow, and as you may remember, mm-hmm. we were basically have to create all of New York City, right? And there's a lot of wide mm-hmm. shots, and we don't, back, in 2002, there wasn't a complete model of all of New York City that you could download, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So there was no real way to do things.
Still isn't.
No. Right. And so we're like, how do we do that? And so obviously we were exploring City Engine and other things. And then some of the guys were deciding, we'll just model a bunch of stuff. And then they realized very quickly, I realized, because I was working, as I came from architecture, and my CG supervisor was also an ex-architect. His name was Andy Weisler. And he said, since you're the architect, why don't you figure this out, how to make the rest of the city? And I said, there are rules in New York City, or, implied rules in terms of how these buildings work. If you just look down the streets and you look at all these aerial photography,
very strict.
There's avenues and then there's streets. And then on the avenues, if you look, the avenues, the corners of the avenues tend to have taller buildings, and then between the avenues tend to have shorter buildings, right? Mm-hmm. And all of these different things. And so it became sort of a thing. So I decided to my own cheapo version was to make these little blocks of buildings, and like massing buildings, and then I designed mm-hmm. these blocks as like little Tetris pieces, so I could just like swap them around and mm-hmm. sort of configure mm-hmm. blocks as I went, and that was fine. and that worked well for the geometry. But then I started saying, okay, well, we'll need a variety of textures that we can swap out between all of these different blocks. And I worked with the texture guys, and then they came back and I realized like that the texture guys did not necessarily know anything about buildings either. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. They were basically, and then they were like, oh, well, no, this facade here is, you know, not the facade that's facing the street. So therefore that one may have, you know, it's a party wall and therefore it may have, you know, a different thing. And then the top floor, you don't just have windows that go all the way up. The top floor is a mechanical floor. So it needs to be different, you know, and that's sort of explaining and explaining. And they said, oh, and I was like, I started realizing that after leaving architecture, I was actually using more of my architectural knowledge outside of architecture compared to you know, because that was the skill that I brought to the table at Digital Domain. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, it was interesting. But it's interesting, right? When you start thinking about that education, an architecture education actually becomes very valuable, even if you're not using it for architecture.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. No, and this is also something that I also share this experience with the creative in the creative field, or especially in visual effects and games, that there's so many super talented artists. But the thing is, even if the basics in architecture are missing, it's just it doesn't work, right?
Right.
Well, it kind of works, but it's there are certain limitations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But actually there was another point. So one of the applications where you can use like a tool like City Engine is, for example, urban planning, where you're using the super simple blocks.
Yep.
Very similar to how you designed them manually for the film.
Yeah.
But then what you can also do you get the correct metrics, so you can actually work with those things on the urban planning side of things. Mm-hmm. And then as discussed now, there's the opportunity to actually use this stuff for the entertainment industries. And this is something that I got more and more into because I did a lot of tech support and did some hobby projects using City Engine. And this actually got me, and I'm lucky for that, headhunted into Scanline Visual Effects out of Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And they were searching for a City Engine specialist that can help them to actually implement the procedural city creation system for their internal pipeline.
Right.
And so I did this between September 2015 and June 2016.
Okay.
And that was my first foray without any experience in visual effects before,
right,
actually getting into leading a team of artists,
right,
and building up a system like that that was completely procedural for the use of visual effects.
So was this a tool that you helped them create a tool? It was not just for one specific project. It was basically to create a tool that would enable them to do that. Is that correct?
So it was City Engine based, mm-hmm. and there's a Noman lecture I gave in 2016 that pretty much gives a very good overview.
Okay.
And it's on YouTube. Just search for Noman City Engine Independence Day Matthias Bueller or something
Got
like
it.
That you'll instantly find
we'll put it. We'll put it in the show links, so you'll have it there.
Ah, very cool. Yeah, because there I'm quickly explaining what it is, but just very short.
Right.
So it's a City Engine based workflow.
Yep.
But the hard thing was actually in how do you use the tool and what are the ingredients that you need, how many textures, how many assets, and then process everything in the procedural system and then spit it out so that it can actually be pushed through the pipeline to actually get rendered.
Right.
So that the cities actually can be rendered. And they obviously, they have a very specific pipeline also using Flowline and bringing everything from City Engine
right.
to Max to be animated or in Maya and so on and so on.
Right.
So that was the challenge also to work with the different departments and pretty much make.
And they render everything in V-Ray. So were you optimizing for V-Ray as well, like creating V-Ray proxies and things? Because obviously this is a massive amount of data, right? So you probably
So that was one of the most challenging things. And so in the city parts, which we created and or layouted and then generated, we had hundreds, if not thousands, of individual buildings, and they were pretty much skyscrapers. And all of the skyscrapers were made out of individual instances. And so, like in the end, they were like converted to proxies,
right?
To V-Ray proxies. Yep. But within each proxy, there were up to three or four material, depending on if it's just a wall or if it's a glass, a window which has a frame, or if it's just a glass, and so on.
Yeah.
And each of those materials actually was a true instance that had a procedural shader driven. So I was working there with one of the programmers at Scanline. Mm-hmm. His name was Jakub. Mm-hmm. And he was specialized in the Chaos Group SDK.
Right, okay.
And he wrote some sort of magic instancer that actually created like hundreds of thousands of shaders on the fly that were just rendered in a breeze. It was just amazing.
Wow. That's pretty impressive.
And that's very cool. So every single window has a complete different shader information. That was really stunning.
So that's basically what helped randomize some of the looks of everything, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Wow.
But the system was still generic enough that that it could actually, or the intention that they obviously can use the system further and further, and they are using or were using the system then also for Power Rangers, for Justice League, a little bit on Guardians 2.
Yep.
And now, meanwhile, it's from how I understand it, it's even been used, or it's been maybe probably developed a little bit further, but also used in the Game of Thrones last season where they won the Emmy. Right.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, I remember, you know, it was interesting as I remember just so this idea of how do you create cities in movies, mm-hmm. right? And it's always been a problem. And Eric Hansen and I have had conversations about this for years. But I remember specifically there was ways on the first Spider-Man movies, like the original ones, you know, the Sony ones, they were basically trying to like figure out how to procedurally define what the city looks like. And I think at that time they were looking at using a system that would use particles in Houdini that would define each part of the building. So every window would be represented by a particle of some kind.
Yeah.
And it was very...
Yeah. That's in the end, that's actually what
right,
we did.
Yeah.
It's like a point cloud,
right.
Pretty much where you have attribution of which asset is instanced and then the whole shader definition.
Right. And so it seems interesting because it seems, I mean, Eric and I, you know, we were a little bit naive back in the early 2000s. They were like, why can't we just build a building? You know, it's just like, why do we have to create that? And it's like, well, because we've got a lot of buildings to build, right? It was very interesting as well. But speaking of Spider-Man, actually, there's another interest. Did you, have you listened to, there's another podcast I did with X-Ray. And he did the Spider-Man game for PS4, and they had to do the same, some other kind of system to optimize it for games, because obviously you have to be able to load this entire city inside of the game. And it's kind of an interesting idea of cities are made up of all these modules of things that are repetitive but different, right?
I didn't listen to that specific podcast, right. But at last year's DEFCON, which is a game conference in Germany, I actually had the opportunity to talk to one of the scientists, I think he's called David Santiago.
Okay.
I think he's the mastermind behind the procedural system that actually creates that city.
Yeah.
And I had a chat with him for about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's impressive. And
yeah.
But what people don't realize is two things. First of all, how much it takes to actually build up a procedural system like that. And then that it's not press a button and everything works. So there's, you get to about, I don't know, maybe 80% of a specific city,
mm-hmm.
but the rest, well, there are some manual steps involved.
Right.
And this is actually exactly one of these core expertises that I gained over the last 10 years is, and this is also why what I'm building my own company, Urban Studios, on is exactly that knowledge. And so we only focus on architecture and creating architectural or buildings and cities. And so the point there is, which approach do you take for which task which you have? So, for example, if I hear that a lot, well, we would like to have a procedural system that can replicate a city. Now, but if you look at, and we come to the back of this, or to the start of this podcast, mm-hmm. is I mentioned at some point in time that a procedural system is a system of rules, a description of semantics that define the rules of how the architecture is built. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at the typical Paris, for example, there are lots of rules that you can say, or you can build a procedural system that spits out this type of archetype of architecture.
Right.
So what is the archetypical building in Paris? Or, for example, or the what's the typical Roman temple and so on. So you can imagine that pretty easily. But what happens if you want to create something that, or if you, let's say you have a procedural system in place which creates something that looks like Paris, mm-hmm. but then you want to switch to something that looks medieval.
Right.
You literally have to throw away the entire procedural system because the whole semantics are all tailor-made for a specific archetype.
Right, right, right.
And this expertise is, to me, is a big, big advantage, but it took me like 10 years to get into the nitty-gritty.
Mm-hmm.
And there I believe, meanwhile, I have quite a lot of knowledge. But then there's also the other side of just not only how you approach architecture, but there are a lot of people that say, well, for cities or in general, to mass produce 3D models, the procedural approach is the right one.
Right.
And there, I would argue against a little bit because there's this thing called art direction.
Right.
Now, the thing is, if you look at just one facade, and there are on our YouTube channel, there's also lectures or presentations which I gave exactly on this, mm-hmm. on this topic. So if you look at, for example, the Candler building, which is a very famous building, if you look at the, or any architecture for that matter, if you look at a facade that has a certain pattern,
yep.
It can have different windows. It can have, for example, or let's just look at the ground floor. So you can have a door on the left. You can have a door in the middle. You can have a door on the right. So that's already an attribute which you have to have to be able to control the art direction of the building.
Right.
Right. Then you have, for example, three types of upper floor patterns.
Okay.
So then there's let's say one control attribute for that controls the pattern types, and another control attribute which actually defines which pattern goes on which floor.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like already three. And then you can say, okay, on which floor maybe you want to you want to switch the different windows that are used in the different patterns. And you start to see that it's exponential in how many attributes you actually need or parameters to even control a procedural system.
Right.
And this, and you have to absolutely find a balance between how may or the speed that you gain from actually build using a procedural system versus the control that you need to have to tame the beast on the art direction side of things. And this is not intuitive at all.
Right. And I think it's people don't, you know, they think that they can just give it the right parameters and then it'll work.
Mm-hmm.
But
Yeah.
That's it. So explain a little bit about your studio now that we're, you know, gotten caught up to the present at this point.
Sweet. So yeah, I founded Urban. At the beginning it was Urban in 2017, and there was I was going in the direction of actually like urban planning, geodesign, 3D GIS, and so on. We did this for about 2 years, but the market, because the geographic data market, the GIS market, is actually now colliding with the BIM market, so the whole architecture, yep, CAD, BIM world. And I had to accept the fact that people are waiting for the gigantic players, like, for example, Esri and Autodesk in their collaboration, and what the future is going to be in these technologies.
Right.
And knowing a lot about procedural systems and actually trying to, as a very small startup, to be able or try and compete in that field, I just decided it's not worth it. We would not have been able to survive that.
Right.
And so I decided pretty much a year ago that we want to focus entirely on go back to the roots, back to the childhood dream when I was 17,
yeah,
and go in the direction of entertainment.
Okay.
But then to actually prove ourselves, we went into more like, let's say, into the turtle shell and start producing high quality content,
mm-hmm,
and upgrading our internal workflow, which we had used for a building production for a PC game, was Transport Fever 2, where we produced over 500 high quality buildings for that simulation, mm-hmm, game. And then we're still updating content and so on. And now with about five, or actually with six people, investing a full year in just creating textures, assets, and the whole very technical baking workflow, mm-hmm, to be actually able to produce high quality buildings.
Right.
That you would not be able to just procedurally generate, because the architecture has to be consistent.
Interesting.
This is now what we are doing. So we are doing the consultancy and services around 3D building in general and how to tackle 3D environments.
Okay.
But then usually, because budgets are usually limited and implementing an entire procedural system is heavily intensive. So what we are now offering is off the shelf stock buildings, which we have started selling on the Unity Asset Store, and now fingers crossed, in a couple of days we will have our own store live. And the intention there is to have really high quality 3D buildings that are drag and drop for game engines, but also at some point in time for visual effects applications. So, for example, for Maya with V-Ray, or Houdini with V-Ray, or I don't know, Houdini natively for Mantra and so on. And the advantage that we have in the system that we have been developing is that we are using certain procedural things,
yep,
certain procedural magic, but the buildings which we are producing are have 5 highly consistent levels of detail.
Okay.
So the highest level of detail you can easily use for visual effects productions for large scale environments. Yeah. We're actually right at the moment working on some visual effects marketing material shots, where you can see like Los Angeles up to the horizon, filled with 3D buildings and trees and so on. But you can use exactly the same building definition also in VR applications and in games, because we have the 5 very consistent levels of detail.
Interesting. I'd be curious, and you said you make them, you know, they would work with V-Ray or whatever as well, right?
We have a very generic definition that is pretty much just FBX files and a set of textures. Okay. And that is very deliberately, because all of the systems actually are using different material systems.
Right.
And we say, okay, we don't...
You want to be agnostic.
Optimize. Yeah. Exactly. Stay agnostic with our content. And we found a structure which is quite optimized and allows very, very interesting things. I've just been in contact with another guy, the VFX, or no, I cannot say who it is. but some guy that is working in the film production, visual effects production. And I told him, well, the advantage is if you have a real-time optimized 3D model plus the highest quality model you can use for offline rendering.
Right.
You can actually go in the direction of doing real-time production and then push, let's say, the animated cameras that you have recorded on set. You can push those off to the render guys, and they can pull in the high-quality buildings.
I'm curious. I would be really curious to see if there's an example that you have that's created at the highest level of detail, because I don't know, you're probably aware that we have another real-time ray tracer called Lavina that we were using.
I was in contact with some of the guys, but we didn't have the contact. I think, what's his name?
Long
Gross. Yeah, I was in contact with him, but that was like at least half a year.
Well, we have it's in public beta now, so you can actually try it. You can download it from our site, but...
I saw that.
Yeah. Because it's a ray tracer, we're able to actually render billions and billions of polygons. We've actually have people that have done that. They basically took the entire architecture project, all the trees, all the blades of grass and everything, and it'll just chew right through it, right? So that's something that I'm actually be curious to see how that would work, because this is an important thing, right? Like figuring out what you've been talking about this whole podcast is a massive amounts of data, massive amounts of information, right? Something that one person can't do all by themselves, right? That's why you need this system.
That's correct. That's correct. And this is exactly why I decided with Urban Studios. I mean, we're still small, but we're doing something that I was actually inspired by The Third Floor. You know these guys, previous company. They just decided, we are starting a company doing something that is like ripped out of the pipeline, and we are building an entire company just on creating Previs.
Right.
And this is what I want to do with architecture. Mm-hmm. I'm creating a company entirely just around the creation of architecture that can be used in large scale environments that are high quality,
right,
so that the visual effects artists that didn't study architecture actually just can pull in from a library but still create very convincing cities.
Right.
And this is exactly the base of what we are doing, and this is also why our company slogan is "We Engineer Architecture."
Right. Nice.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's basically, you know, there are so many choices that like, you know, people know, like a mechanical floor as an example, right? They don't know that that's there.
Yeah.
And this, your system, like,
correct.
Oh, we know that there's there. It's supposed to be there, so we'll put it in for you. But
Exactly. It's just trying to, or I see that the industries are more and more getting specialized, and the buildings we are producing, for example, they can be used in games. They can be used in visual effects. maybe not hero quality, but hero quality is built for the story manually anyway. But then anything or the buildings can also be used in the field of autonomous driving. So we're in contact with some companies there.
Yeah.
Or firefighting simulators. Yep. So and or VR, AR, VR backgrounds. And I see the specialization more in the sense of we are here to help with the hard work in creating the consistent architecture, while other people that have other talents can focus on gameplay, right, storytelling, movie production, or whatever they need to do.
I'll just use the example of the autonomous driving, because I understand it because I've been following this, but some people may not realize. But when you're doing autonomous driving, most of what the systems need to do is they need to learn, right? So it's a whole it's about a deep learning process. Yeah. And so instead of having a bunch of cars that are not very good at driving around the city and crashing into things until they get better.
In the real
right,
world.
So you need to create a virtual city that they can practice in. So they're basically giving the system a game to play. So I guess what you can do with your procedural cities is like, here's a city that you may never have seen before, learn to navigate your way through this and drive through this and not get into an accident. So that's very important. Yeah.
Correct. And that's exactly also one of the fields where we did some consulting work, for example, for BMW, but there's so many
architecture, right? So they,
that's exactly the
they
point.
They just need the architecture.
That's exactly the point. Stick to the core expertise, and everybody will in the end come or get to higher quality faster.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, architects still have a role to be architects and create original ideas, but this is not the role of what you're doing. So
There's not enough time to learn everything in life. Sad. It's a very, very hard lesson.
That's a great example. I think it's a really cool thing that you're doing. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, and as long as people know that, like, this is the thing that you can use, that's a really great tool and a really great asset. So, well, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for being able to do this. I'm so glad we're able to make these remote connections work.
I think. Yeah, I'm glad it worked. Well, fingers crossed that it actually did work.
I've done a few tests, so far it works. There's a few things that always bother me when you're doing remote, and that's the latency. But I don't think we have much latency. Yeah. I think we're actually doing pretty good.
No, it's working. It's working really well.
So this system is pretty cool. I was. When all of this happened, and I was like, okay, I have to stop being so stubborn. I can't do these podcasts in person anymore. Obviously, I have to be locked in my house for the whole time. I found this system that's pretty great because it keeps the audio quality high, and then we're able to connect with it. So this has been really cool. So thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it. And where can people find out more about your studio and look up information on that? What's a good place for them to go?
So more info is at vrbn.io. Yep. So it's maybe a little bit confusing, but it's called Urban Studios, but it's written VRBN. It has like this VR connotation. It's all the old Roman letters that didn't have a U, they just had a V. It's a creative mix, right? So definitely our website vrbn.io, and then but also I'm very active on LinkedIn, so you can just hook me up on LinkedIn under Matthias Bueller.
Perfect. All right, well, thank you so much, Matthias. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and the great chat.